This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Former hedge funder Raj Rajaratnam is back in the news this week. He lost his appeal on the Galleon hedge fund conviction and is still in jail. Anita Raghavan is here to talk about the fall of Raj and Galleon in her book, The Billionaire's Apprentice.
How could you indict Rajat Gupta on Diwali, which is the Hindu festival of lights? And Preet Bharara says, gosh, I didn't know it was Diwali.
Lions, tigers, and bears have long inhabited the American imagination, even though they are not really part of our reality. What is our fascination with wild creatures? John Mualim joins us from San Francisco to talk about his book, Wild Ones.
We actually have to do these very hands-on, intensive interventions kind of all the time.
And apparently, inside, every journalist is a wannabe thriller writer. Adam Labore talks about why it's not so easy to make that leap. And Greg Coles will be here to talk about bestsellers.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Anita Raghavan is here with us today. She is the author of The Billionaire's Apprentice, The Rise of the Indian American Elite and the Fall of the Galleon Hedge Fund, our cover review this week, June 30th. Hi, Anita.
Hi, Pamela. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming. A big story. Obviously, you reported for many years for the Wall Street Journal. You now write for Dealbook, and you've been reporting on this story. Tell us about the Galleon hedge fund and what happened for those who haven't been reading the business pages.
The Galleon hedge fund, for most of its life, was a very successful hedge fund. It grew to be $7 billion, but its founder, Raj Rajaratnam, had honed a business model of producing superior returns by getting corporate secrets from insiders. For many, many years, that allowed Galleon to outperform other funds. But somewhere around 2006, the Fed started looking at actually Raj's brother's fund, Sedna Capital, and that eventually led them to Raj Rajaratnam. And he was arrested, of course, on October 16, 2009, tried and convicted, and his fund shut down. And it was the end of a magical story of South Asian success.
Now, he has the biggest jail term, prison term yet for an insider trading case, correct?
That's right.
When is he in there until?
Well, he's in there until about 2021.
When we talk about these sources, that's also a big part of the story. Who were his sources for this inside information?
A lot of them were South Asians that had grown up in Silicon Valley around the same time he was getting his start on Wall Street. Raj would travel out to San Francisco and meet these executives. When they came to New York, he would often rent a limousine and take them down to Atlantic City. And remember, in the mid-80s, when Raj started out, there weren't as many South Asian executives on Wall Street or in Silicon Valley. So the ties that Raj was able to forge, you know, using a similar ethnic identity were quite strong and led to some very constructive relationships, at least for him.
Now, we're talking about Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan. Where was Raj from, and what was his sort of background? How did he get into this?
Raj was actually from Sri Lanka, and he was from quite a wealthy family. His father was a singer executive. He went to a private school in Sri Lanka, and then as a teenager, he was sent to boarding school in England to an all-boys school called Dulwich. And one of the things that differentiated him from some of the other South Asians who came to Wharton in the early 1980s is that he had actually traveled outside of Sri Lanka before he even got to America. So he was actually one of the privileged.
I mean, why now? Was there something going on in South Asian culture or the education system that brought all of these superstars into finance specifically?
Well, I think it's a couple things, actually. In the book, I refer to this concept of the twice-blessed generation. This refers to Rajat Gupta, Anil Kumar, and many of the main protagonists who were born after Indian independence. what that meant is they were open to a host of educational opportunities that their forefathers did not have. The Indian Institutes of Technology, which have now become a hothouse of corporate talent the world over, were born in the 1950s after independence. Nehru, India's first prime minister, wanted a way for India to compete with the world. He thought the country needed engineers.
Now, is this a college? Is it a university for undergraduates?
It is a university for undergraduates, and it produced a whole generation of very technologically empowered engineers. It happens that they were coming of age at the same time as the United States in the mid-1960s relaxed its immigration laws. It had just come out of the civil rights struggle. And so there were an abundance of opportunities available to the very technologically minded Indians and South Asians who were coming over. The U.S. also at the same time was grappling with the Cold War. And so the Indians were sort of the perfect immigrants.
And they came over here and then they would often go on to business school, to Harvard, to Wharton. And you have two figures in here. So it's not just Raj, but also you focus on Rajat Gupta.
Yes, Rajat Gupta is very different from Raj Rajaratnam. He actually came from a very humble background. It was a family that was wealthy in education, but poor in material riches.
Where did they grow up? Where was this?
He was born in Calcutta and then came of age in Delhi. And he was orphaned before he was 16. And he really, as the eldest son in an Indian family, he had to shoulder all the responsibilities. So while Raj was having this rather cushy life, if you will, of going to private schools, Rajat was taking weekends off from IIT and to look in on his younger sister and brother. Rajat, though, succeeded in getting into Harvard Business School and then, of course, getting to McKinsey, a very white shoe firm. In his early years, he actually struggled at McKinsey. You know, a lot of his South Asian baggage, being too quiet, sort of hindered him. But
McKinsey's the big corporate consulting firm.
That's right. That's right. It's a global juggernaut. In the 80s, he turned around Scandinavia and then Chicago. And by the 1990s, you know, he was a real candidate for the younger generation to be the person to lead the firm.
Now, what brings these two people together in this story?
Well, Pamela, sad as it is, it's money. nothing more than that. Rajat Gupta and Raj Rajaratnam were not close friends. Gupta didn't go to Raj's flamboyant 50th birthday party in Kenya, where you know, he flew 70 guests on a chartered flight, and they wined and dined for about 5 days. They were really drawn by money. You know, Rajat Gupta steps down from the helm of McKinsey in July 2003, and he has come through this difficult period. You know, it's been very hard managing McKinsey because of the technology bubble bursting. And I think he wanted a second act, a spectacular second act. Raj Rajaratnam, someone he didn't really foster before this, seemed to be his agent for that. And, you know, if you want to compare it to literature, I think the relationship is much like, you know, Rajat being Othello and Raj being Iago. Essentially, they team up on a business venture called New Silk Route, which is their way of building a South Asian money management firm. And Raj welcomes Rajat into his offices. He starts spending more time there. Unfortunately, one thing leads to another, and soon he's making calls into Goldman board meetings from Galleon's offices. Ultimately, of course, the centerpiece of the government's case, calling Raj Rajaratnam 1 minute after he gets off a Goldman board call on September 23rd, 2008, where the Goldman board has just signed off on Warren Buffett's $5 billion investment in the bank that, you know, happens at the peak of the financial crisis. Rajat Gupta calls Rajaratnam, and minutes later, Raj Rajaratnam buys a boatload of Goldman Sachs.
Rajaratnam is behind bars. What has happened to Gupta? Where is he now?
Gupta is mainly staying in Westport, Connecticut, which is he bought the James Cash Penney estate about a decade ago when he moved to New York. He's keeping close to home, waiting to hear the outcome of his appeal, which was heard in May. And, you know, I think trying to spend a lot of time with his family in case he ends up leaving him.
And you're still following this story actively.
That's right. That's right.
it wasn't just Gupta and Rajaratnam coming from South Asia in this huge story. I mean, there were South Asians on really on all sides.
That's right.
So at the SEC and the government, who were the other players here?
Just as Gupta was retiring, actually, at the SEC, Sanjay Wadhwa joined as a line attorney. And he was the one who began looking into the Galleon case. And he really built it from a case focused on Raj's brother, Rangan, to a much bigger case focused on Raj and then later Rajat Gupta. And then you have Preet Bharara, who is at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And for all intents and purposes, he's a second-generation Indian. And I think that's another fascinating thing about this story, because most of the criminal defendants are first-generation Indians, and most of the people who are on the side of prosecuting them are second-generation Indians. Preet Bharara, for instance, born in India, but came to the United States as a toddler, really soaked in U.S. values of justice and law, perhaps not as tied to his ethnic roots as a Rajat Gupta or an Anil Kumar. At one point in the case, on the day that Rajat is indicted, Preet Bharara's father actually calls him and says, "How could you indict Rajat Gupta on Diwali, which is the Hindu festival of lights?" And Preet Bharara says, "Gosh, I didn't know it was Diwali."
That's so fascinating. Are there broader cultural or social implications? I mean, what is the South Asian community kind of made of this case? Do they think these are just two guys who got caught doing bad things, or did it lead to broader introspection about culture?
I think initially, you know, there was grave concern that these individuals were being targeted because they were South Asian. But one of the things that I've learned sort of in my journey on my book tour, really, is that the South Asian community today is a very diverse and vibrant group. While I certainly have fielded questions about, you know, is this a sign of prejudice against South Asians, there are also a number of people that have come to me and said, you know, this is exactly the kind of case that should be prosecuted. This happens in India all the time. And it's good to see that you know, it's being brought to light in the United States, sort of embracing the new heroes of the story. You know, Preet Bharara this week is speaking at the South Asian Bar Convention out on the West Coast. I, too, have gotten a lot of, you know, offers to speak as a result of the book. And while initially there was great hand-wringing, because Rajat Gupta was an icon, you know, in the Indian-American community. He was one of the few people who had actually attended all three White House dinners for Dr. Manmohan Singh in the last decade and invited by presidents on both sides of the aisle. At first, you know, people didn't want to believe it was true.
Well, Anita Raghavan, thanks so much for being here. I'm sure we'll hear more from you on this. Anita writes for the New York Times Deal Book as well as for Forbes and is obviously continuing to cover an unfolding story. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Obsessed, America's Food Addiction, and My Own, written and read by Mika Brzezinski, the co-anchor on MSNBC's Morning Joe. That's Obsessed by Mika Brzezinski, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Wild Ones is the new book from John Mualim that has an interesting subtitle. It is a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. John is calling in from San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi.
Tell us what is sometimes dismaying and weirdly reassuring about this story here.
Right.
Right. Well, the sometimes dismaying part, I think, hits you in the face right away. I mean, I started this book, really as someone who was really interested in wildlife, but in from a kind of vicarious point of view. I didn't have a lot of, experience even like going camping or anything. I just mostly watched Planet Earth on TV and stuff. And as I started to do reporting about, what's going on in the world of wild animals right now, and especially endangered species, it was, I was just sort of awestruck at how complicated everything's gotten in terms of preserving some of these species. You know, it's no longer true that we can just kind of fix a problem and walk away and let these animals get on with their lives, but that we actually have to do these very hands-on, intensive interventions kind of all the time and just keep doing them perpetually if we want these things to survive.
And sometimes seems that we do these protections, and then there's almost like people get frightened of the result. So you bring back the coyote or whatever it might be, and then everybody thinks, there are coyotes.
Right. Yeah. That's a cycle that I sort of picked up on, and it's been some of the book talking about, because really, what I was most interested in talking about was just sort of ordinary people's experience of animals, even if it's just a kind of imaginative experience or the way we think and feel about these things that we know are out there. And yeah, I mean, a great example is, I talk about this book, this study in Southern California, where they looked at all the ways mountain lions were talked about in the Los Angeles Times over a period of about 20 years. And at first, there were almost no mountain lions left. They'd all been hunted. And people were celebrating mountain lions as these symbols of America's natural heritage and these, poetic wildness of the animals. And then they start rebounding and they come back and they kill a few dogs, and suddenly there's these, killers laying in wait in the mountains, coming for your babies.
Not as much fun to go for that hike in Topanga Canyon.
Exactly. It just made me realize, just how subjective these things are. We think of, wildlife and conservation as being a science, but actually it's really just a lot of ideas floating around these animals that seem to matter most.
And how did you write for the New York Times Magazine, of course. Did this come out of a story you did for the Times, or how did you get to this idea?
Yeah, in retrospect, it kind of came out of two stories. One I had written about this group Operation Migration, which I went back and spent some more time with for the book. And these are guys who fly these little ultralight airplanes and teach whooping cranes to migrate with the airplanes. They train them to fly behind the planes, and then they spend all winter teaching them to fly from Wisconsin to Florida. And doing that reporting was really when I just realized, how elaborate all of this recovery work really was. And then I did another story a short while later about research into whether animals basically can be gay, whether there's gay sex in the animal world. And that was when I really started realizing just how these perceptions of animals, just ordinary people's perceptions of animals, just how kind of delightfully confused they can get. You had a lot of people arguing about what are the implications for humans if, two albatross females can be a couple. What does that mean? Does that mean that, human lesbians should be able to marry and things like this? All these arguments that spin out of animals. And really, that was the approach I took with the book, to just kind of use the animals as these props that set in motion a lot of human dramas.
Going back to the whooping cranes, I mean, why did whooping cranes need to be taught how to migrate?
Yeah, well, that's a case where, really the bird was almost extinct. The whooping crane, for people who don't know, is the tallest North American bird. It's this big white bird, and it was almost gone by the 30s. And now they've been breeding them in captivity basically ever since then. Normally a bird would learn to migrate from its parents. The parents would teach it. But the birds that they're breeding in captivity, their parents are still back in the lab. So when they release these chicks into the wild in Wisconsin, they're never going to migrate unless someone's there to show them. So these guys have basically used the airplane as a proxy for the parent. And they have to also wear these frumpy white costumes, almost like bird costumes, so that the birds don't realize that they're following a human being, because the whole idea is to produce wild birds, birds that are going to be, averse to people and not like, the Canada geese that kind of hang around on field hockey yards. And so there's this big subterfuge, this big kind of like Truman Show existence that they do. And what was amazing was I really thought, you couldn't get any more absurd looking than this. You couldn't get a better symbol of just how involved our activities are to prop up these species. But as I spent, a season with these guys and really got to know them personally and really see kind of the idiosyncratic ways that they felt invested in the work that they're doing and the dedication that it takes, even in a situation where they know, you know, all this work could very well be futile. I mean, they understand that, and they will tell you that. That, I think, weirdly was, well, the weirdly reassuring part of the story, you know, sort of rose out of that, of just seeing the real dignity in trying to accomplish some of this stuff.
You talk about two other animals that you focus on in this book, the polar bear, obviously maybe a little bit more well-known in terms of its dilemma and or the dilemma we've imposed on it.
The polar bear, you know, I wanted to write about the polar bear exactly because I felt like it had been written about so much, and it's become such a celebrity and a symbol for climate change, and really it's being used as a kind of rallying point, or, you know, a focal point for, you know, these debates. And
the poster bear.
Exactly, yeah, it's a poster bear, exactly. And so I really wanted to look at how does an animal become celebrified, I guess, or Disneyfied like that. Again, you know, most of what I was focusing on is the people who get wrapped up in the stories of these animals, and really I found it was a pretty deliberate and pretty shrewd move by environmentalists. You know, there's a big kind of intricate legal backstory that I go into the book and exactly why they needed an animal like the polar bear to represent climate change. But it was really a case where they felt like the animal could stand for something larger, and they knew that it was something that would resonate with the public, unlike, you know, a lot of these, like, you know, little anonymous birds that nest on glaciers and things, which they had tried to use before and just, you know, didn't really whip up any excitement.
Right, the less beloved species of frog.
Yeah, there's these kind of off-brand animals that, you know, people are always trying to get us to care about, and we just don't care. And there's some really interesting reasons why. I mean, I've found these great social science studies, you know, showing, you know, what kind of face types of animals people like more, and, you know, whether they like animals with arms and legs or without arms and legs. Just some really bizarre research on that front.
No, I mean, a lot of this you talk about children, that these ideas come from when we're young.
Yeah, well, that was really why, you know, I got going on the book. Was I was doing all this reporting about conservation for the magazine right around the time my daughter was born, and was just overwhelmed with how many, you know, how much animal paraphernalia we had in our house suddenly, you know, from stuffed animals to, you know, onesies with butterflies on them. I mean, they just seem to be everywhere. And as one conservationist put it to me, you know, right when someone's learning to be human, we surround them with animals, which when you step back and think about it, is sort of amazing. But I also realized that, you know, my ideas about wildlife probably weren't so different from the romantic animal world that we show to our kids. And I think that's probably true for a lot of adults, that we tend to just have this idea of wildlife as being just getting along fine, you know, off in the woods, autonomously doing its own thing, and it's a happy little world, and it has nothing to do with us. And, you know, I was finding that that's just not the case anymore.
When you finished all your reporting for this book, how did your view of animals change from that, you know, initial kind of childish, romanticized view?
I was pretty pessimistic and you know, when I started the book, I mean, I'd just become a father for the first time, and I was thinking, you know, about the future in a new way and what, you know, might be left of the natural world. And I really think that, you know, it's sort of hard to sum up, but I'm hoping that reading the book, you know, someone would actually kind of, you know, their experience of reading the book would mirror the experience I went through, which was, you know, feeling initially sort of deflated at just, you know, where we've gotten to on planet Earth. I mean, the fact that it now takes people dressed like birds, teaching birds to fly to keep these whooping cranes in place. But then really, as you get to know some of the characters working on it, and as you sort of peel back the layers of, you know, how they feel about these animals, and this kind of the persistence that's out there, you know, amid all this uncertainty, and that these are people who really have felt some of the same discomfort that I felt, but just really tried to latch onto, you know, just one thing that they thought was worth saving, and really thrown themselves into solving that problem. That's the weirdly reassuring part. I mean, it is weirdly reassuring. You know, it doesn't necessarily, I can't even really say that you're going to walk away feeling, you know, more hopeful about some of these things. I mean, I did, but I think reassurance is a different feeling. Reassurance is just a feeling that there's a certain rightness to what's going on, and that there's a certain nobility to humans, you know, that we're not just a destructive influence, but that there's something very beautiful about the dignity that we bring to solve some of these problems.
John, I understand that you're going on a very unusual kind of book tour for this book with the band.
Yeah, there's a band called Black Prairie, which is features a bunch of members of the Decemberists. They're a folk band, and they've actually released a soundtrack for Wild One. So they wrote all these songs that are based around different scenes or characters in the book. It turned out really cool. I don't think either of us really knew what to expect when we decided to collaborate this way. But now we've done a few shows on the West Coast, and we're going to do some more in the summer and fall. We're coming to New York in July. We're basically, I tell a series of stories from the book, and they've adapted the music to kind of orchestrate it in the way you might hear music, you know, behind a radio story or something like that.
Right.
So we're doing these kind of mini, you know, Wild Ones roadshow tours.
All right. Well, I guess the next thing in book tours.
I don't know. It's definitely really fun. We'll see, you know, what the payoff is from a kind of marketing standpoint. But we're just having so much fun, so we just want to keep doing it.
Thanks, John, for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah.
That was John Moo Allen, author of Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. Adam Labor is calling in very appropriately from Budapest to talk about the art of writing spy fiction and thrillers. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
You are, by day, a foreign correspondent.
I am, yes. I'm based in Budapest. I've been covering Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and bits of the Balkans for 20 years on and off.
And you write for The Economist and The Times of London, occasionally for us here at The New York Times?
Yes, and also occasionally quite often for Monocle magazine as well.
But you also have this alter ego as a thriller writer.
Yes. By night, by day, I'm a foreign correspondent. By night, I'm lurking in the shadows, prowling around, looking for intrigue and conspiracies.
But this was not an easy transition. It's a subject of an essay you've written for us this week. Tell us about what the big challenge is.
Well, the big challenge was, you know, every foreign correspondent, I think, dreams or secretly dreams of becoming a thriller writer and hitting the big time like Frederick Forsyth did. But what I realized was when I started on this path a good 10 years ago in my first attempts was that really, in a way, being a journalist is not good training at all, because we're trained to explain everything really quickly and really simply for readers. You know, it's the who, what, when, where, why, how, some quotes, and the cell par, or the nut graph, as you call it in the States, I believe. And then when you're trying to write a thriller, you know, or any kind of fiction, but perhaps especially a conspiracy thriller, this is awful, because you know, my first drafts of my first thriller, The Budapest Protocol, they were kind of like a memo. The conspiracy was founded here, and the hero finds out about it here, and then it all ends happily ever after here, and then you think, I don't know, how am I going to get a novel out of this?
Right, because the idea with a good news story is that by that nut graph or that third paragraph, that they know, you know, exactly what happened, and there are not any huge questions lurking, whereas I imagine the opposite.
Yes, I mean, even, you know, if you look at the old-fashioned books on journalism, and I'm sure the rule still holds true today, it's the pyramid. The most important stuff's at the top. The reader might not make it to the bottom, you know, amazingly enough, no matter how scintillating our prose is. So you've got to get that stuff at the top. Why this matters, you know, what happened, how it happened, why it happened, and why it matters. And though this is just the worst possible training for fiction, where really you have to learn a whole new load of skills, how to obfuscate, send the reader down false trails, and put clues in that might or might not be relevant. But the other thing I learned, which was very interesting, which is that readers, especially of this kind of genre, they're very experienced and they're pretty smart. So if you drop a hint in a very early page, it will echo 200 or 300 pages later. If the reader's, you know, captivated by your story, you can do this. And so the urge to explain, once you beat it, you know, the urge to make things more mysterious kicks in. And the readers like that, because really they like to make the connections themselves.
I mean, I think it must be daunting with genre fiction, especially because when you have genre readers, they're so devoted. So the mystery readers, like, they know how it's supposed to work. The thriller readers, the spy novel readers, they know how it's supposed to go, that you have this readership that's hugely informed and discerning. And if you're going out there for the first time, it must be a kind of frightening expedition.
Yes. I mean, you have to have just an incredible amount of self-belief. And I think a lot of my fellow novelists would probably admit this as well, that you have to be careful it doesn't really veer into, you know, too much, you know, self-navel-gazing and almost self-obsession. You have to have an incredible amount of self-belief. because you're sitting there in front of a blank computer screen nowadays, and making up a story and inventing characters and telling, you know, the whole narrative of the story. And as you say, people are very experienced readers now. There's very, very good people out there writing spy books. And, you know, it's very presumptuous to do that. But on the other hand, I mean, that's how the first storytelling started, probably in the caves, when people came back and said, you know, how they killed the mammoth or dodged the predator. I mean, someone has to have the confidence to sit down and start telling that story. And I think also in my thriller, The Geneva Option, I had something a bit specialized to offer, because it's a conspiracy thriller at the start of a series set in and around the United Nations. And it grew out of a non-fiction book I wrote called Complicity with Evil, which was an investigative book which examined the role of the UN and its failures in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Darfur. And that's when I really picked up a lot about how the UN really works, and that this strange building on 45th Street and First Avenue is just, it's like the last days of the Roman Empire crossed with the Borgia's palace. There's just so much intrigue and conspiracy and backbiting in real life. So then I thought, well, let's, you know, crank that up a bit and dramatize it and turn it into fiction.
Wouldn't it be so much more interesting if this person did, you know, X, and you didn't have to sort of tell them more stayed what actually happened version?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, that's the great joy of fiction, is that you can let your imagination run riot. And so the heroine of The Geneva Option, Yael Azulay, you know, she's a woman, and her job is to do the dirty deals behind the scenes that keep diplomacy rolling and keep the wheels of big business turning, and she's prepared to make those compromises because she thinks it's in the greater good, until she's asked to do something that is way beyond anything she's ever done before, and she refuses and goes rogue. So that's kind of, you know, grew out of my experience looking at the role of UN officials and the kind of decisions they were taking. And there was one particular bit which helped inspire the start of the book, was when I was doing my book Complicity, I met someone from my UN department, and people didn't really want to talk to me in public, so I had to meet people in corridors and in cafe corners. And the best one was, someone I knew took me out onto a balcony on the 37th floor of the building on the inner air shaft. And this is like a whole glimpse of the UN from that you've never seen before. It was very dark. It was very grimy. It was quite scary. It was a tiny balcony, and you could feel the lift making the building rattle. And I just thought, wow, this is just a perfect place for a murder.
I was going to say,
someone off there.
Hopefully not your own.
You know, that's how the start of the book came to me. It starts with a murder scene on a balcony, which directly came from me standing there. I don't really like heights, so I was quite nervous there, and I was glad when the source had given me the information and we could go back onto more solid ground. But and I just thought, this is a great place, and it all sort of rolled out from there.
You know, if inside every lawyer is a secret John Grisham wannabe, for the thriller writer, the model, as you mentioned earlier, is Frederick Forsyth. And you talked to Forsyth about this, the transition he made from being a reporter for Reuters and the BBC to writing The Day of the Jackal.
The main lesson he had was a very straightforward one. He said, you must, you know, write about what you know. Although obviously he hadn't taken part in a plot to assassinate General de Gaulle, he knew a lot about France and about Algeria. And we forget now that when France left Algeria, how much fury and anger that caused in France during the 1960s. So he was really on the case about that. And that's what his advice for the new generation of thriller writers nowadays is, really write about what you know, write about Afghanistan if you've been there, write about Iraq if you've been there, or Somalia. And, you know, people are picking that up because there's other thriller writers. You know, Dan Fesperman from the Baltimore Sun, he's written a number of very good spy books, and a Reuters reporter called John Fullerton, who's not so well known but has written some great books. The New York Times' own ex-Alex Berenson has done some really great stuff and tackled some really topical stories about Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, that gets into this other thing that you touch on in the essay, which is that with a 24-hour news cycle, with everything sort of getting sped up in terms of reporting these real stories, that similarly this has affected the way in which thrillers are written.
I think the age of digitalization has opened up a lot of new opportunities, because you can write an e-book in perhaps a month, say, or 6 weeks, and it might be 20 or 30,000 words. And it can be up on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and on the iTunes store in a couple of weeks. It's, everything goes so much faster now. You know, it used to be, for a general novel, at least a year, really, sometimes a bit longer. But because of the ebook format and the way that the world works now, you can do things much quicker. I wrote a short story, just a 7,000-word short story, with my heroine, Yael Azulay, and it was inspired by a story I read in the New York Times, in part, by C.J. Chivers, about America helping channel arms supplies to the Syrian rebels. So I used that as a starting point, and then brought in some other material about rendition and torture of suspects, of terrorist suspects. And, you know, it was called the Istanbul Exchange. It took a couple of, 2 or 3 weeks to write. It's quite short. And then 2 weeks later, it was up there. And it's available free as a download. So I think this offers a lot of opportunities for people, for thriller writers dealing with things that are in the news. I mean, of course, you know, sometimes the news even outstrips fiction. I mean, if I suggested perhaps a thriller where a former NSA executive is holed up in a hotel in Hong Kong while the world's media are chasing him around and he's secretly ordering pizza, then flies to Moscow and is marooned in the transit lounge at Sheremetyevo Airport while the Russian foreign minister says he hasn't crossed the Russian border, which may be technically true. You know, you'd think I was living in a fantasy land, but look, I mean, anyone can see the news. So there's fantastic opportunities nowadays, I think, for shorter and punchier thrillers, as well as the, you know, the old style 300 or 400-page epics.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you so much.
That was Adam Labor. He is the author of The Geneva Option and The Istanbul Exchange, talking to us from Budapest about the challenges of being a journalist and writer of thrillers. Hi, I'm Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review, and I am here with my colleague Greg Coles, also an editor at the Book Review and our bestsellers columnist. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So what is new on the list this week?
Really not a lot. So let me start by talking about some books that are not on the list. In a week that saw the death of the popular thriller writer Vince Flynn at age 47 of prostate cancer, I thought his titles might get a posthumous bump. He did have a bestseller back in January with a book that I think was called The Last or The Last Man. But if they did get a bump, it wasn't enough to return any of them to the list. And also in a very bad week for the celebrity chef Paula Deen, I wondered if her troubles might lead some people to pick up her 2007 memoir, It Ain't All About the Cooking, which, by the way, contains an incident near the very beginning that's just ripe for readers looking to psychoanalyze her views on race. But again, making the news doesn't automatically correlate to making the list.
Yeah, maybe it'll actually go in the other direction for her.
none of her many cookbooks are on the list right now either. So whatever interest there is in her personal life has not driven interest in her books. What is new on the list? On the combined fiction list, there are just three new titles this week. The highest ranking new title is at number 2, and that is Neil Gaiman's new novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane. What's interesting here is that on the hardcover list, that title is at number 1, where it dislodges Dan Brown's Inferno. Inferno is still selling well enough on ebooks and also in hardcover that it's still number 1 on the combined.
So they have flipped places. Inferno is number 1 on the combined. More people are reading it
overall
reading it on ebooks, but on the hardcover, people are going for the Gaiman.
Yeah, on the hardcover list, part of that, we asked our bestseller department why it is that the Gaiman has outpaced Inferno on our hardcover list. The answer seems to have something to do with independent bookstores. There's a website, IndieBound, that tracks sales just at independent bookstores. And the Gaiman is number 1 on their list as well. They compile their bestsellers. Gaiman is number 1 on that list, and Dan Brown is actually down at number 3 on that list. So in independent bookstores, he has fallen off a bit, and that explains somewhat why Neil Gaiman is number 1 on our hardcover list, but number 2 on the combo list.
So a bit of a horse race up there at the top.
Yeah, there's a lot of big sellers out there right now. Then at number four on the combined fiction list, Janet Ivanovich is back. She's started a new series with a writer named Lee Goldberg. The first book in that series is called The Heist, and it's about a female FBI agent who teams up with a male con man. And this book is they're trying to catch a rogue banker, kind of a banker's gone wild type book.
Topical topic.
Yes. And finally, the last new title on the combined fiction list this week is down at number 13, Tammy Hoag, mystery, kind of a dark thriller mystery writer, former romance writer who got sick of kind of sunshine and wanted to go dark.
Go to the dark side.
Exactly. She has a new mystery out called The Ninth Girl about a serial killer on the loose in Minneapolis. And then there's only one new title on the nonfiction list this week, on the combined list or the hardcover nonfiction list. That title is at number 12 on the combined nonfiction list. It's by a woman named Lily Koppel, a former society reporter for the New York Times, who had a bestseller several years ago called The Red Leather Diary. Her new book is called The Astronaut Wives Club, and it's kind of a right stuff for women. It's about the Mercury 7 astronauts, the first astronauts in America's, the early days of America's space program. About the wives of those astronauts and what their marriages were like. Really, a lot of them weren't very good, and they had to put on this big pretense of them being good in order for their husbands to advance their careers.
Life magazine covers.
Yes, and there's a famous cover of Life magazine, which is now being used as the cover of the book, that was a model of the Mercury capsule with all of the seven wives posed around it in their housewife dresses. There's something very much kind of Mad Men to this book. It's nostalgia for the middle of the century, and also of all of the housewives, the Real Housewives reality shows.
Well, maybe it'll be grittier in the next installment following the path of Mad Men. Thanks so much, Craig.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.